White Area and Resistance calling. White Area and Resistance radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, here in the bunker, transmitting from north central Indiana today on a foggy day on February the 11th, 2015. Wednesday, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Well, I just got through recording a long interview with John Gotti, Jr. He's got a new book coming out, and I think it's going to be very good, and it's good for our people to read it because it shows how the government and the FBI and all these people work and do their sneaky, sleazy deeds, you know, like racketeering charges. All racketeering charges is unconstitutional, of course, but forget the Constitution. Forget that. Power corrupts, and the powerful that are corrupt get what they want. And this book brings it out very, very well. And the treatment of John Gotti Sr. in Marion Prison over in Illinois, where we've had friends over there too. And the water is terrible. They cut off his provisions inside. He had to drink regular water, and that water is very carcinogenic in Marion Prison. Subsequently, they say, you know, he died of cancer. But died of cancer because he was forced to drink that rotten water, and he got cancer of the mouth and so forth. Ultimately died. Anyhow, I've recorded that interview, and if I can find it on my recorder, I've got one of these recorders that's, you know, you'd think an audio recorder is very simple, but Radio Shack was selling off some recorders for a very cheap price. I bought a couple, and my webmaster bought a couple, and I thought I had it conquered, but I still haven't got it quite figured out. Now, I know that sounds stupid, but if you had one of these things in front of you, you'd know what I mean, as far as you could record, and then you can't find the file, then you can't play it back, and then the audio doesn't come out, and but I'll get it conquered. I always do. I may have to go for help, though. Well, let's go back to our book, A Man Called Lucy, today, which shows us pretty much that the American and the German intelligence services during World War II didn't actually hold a candle to the importance of Rudolf Rösler, who was sitting down in Switzerland with his 10-person cell in Germany that was passing along all the information from the high command. It's amazing, as I read, and I've read quite a bit on this, how poor the intelligence service, the OKW and so forth, was in Germany, and its western branch in the United States was nothing. So anyhow, let's go on with the book. Rösler has made his contacts. They're all set up. They're passing information. He passed information on everything Hitler was doing in his attack on Belgium and through the Low Countries and the British at Dunkirk and all that. He told them what was going to happen, what Hitler's plans were, but these countries didn't listen to him, and Hitler rolled right over them. So now he's set up. They're getting set up for the Russian Operation Barbarossa, and it's amazing the information that Rösler had that he had trouble giving to the Russians. He had actually asked for pay before they would believe him. He was given the German plans to them free, and they suspected him of being someone who was just involved with screwing him up. He's also got at least a couple of women involved too that were expert in the spy business. Okay, here we go. Foote's first concern on moving in was to find a radio mechanic who would be willing to install an aerial running entirely around his flat, an indispensable requirement if he were to correspond with Moscow successfully from Switzerland. Foote convinced the electrician who carried out the installation that he was an eccentric English millionaire trapped in Switzerland by the outbreak of the war who wished to be able to hear the BBC broadcast with perfect clarity. The care Foote took over his cover reveals that in a very short time he had transformed himself from an amateur spy into an experienced agent. In fact, Foote's dramatic talents were such that he was accepted at face value by the entire colony of retired British Army officers and civil servants living in Lausanne, Switzerland, at Auchy. Now, it's amazing to me that they were able to have reliable communication shortwave between Switzerland and Moscow, because having been involved in ham radio for years and understand the various facets with an antenna inside a building, that would be difficult. They saw nothing unusual in the fact that the capricious bachelor should show an obvious reluctance to invite them into his home, or that the rhythm of his life should be unique. He rose late, did little during the day, and wrote, it seemed, well into the night. This mask also confounded the alien department of the Swiss police, which came to make inquiries shortly after Foote moved in. He put on a masterful performance for the benefit of two differential police inspectors, offering them the best whiskey and showing them bank statements that left no doubt of his private means. Sonia had entrusted him with the funds of the center before leaving for England. Of course, he realized that he was really breaking the law concerning foreigners in the Confederation. He knew, he assured them, that he ought to reside in one of the hostels or camps that had been put at their disposal, but he hated crowds and wanted a place of his own. However, he had no desire to cause embarrassment to his host and was quite ready to follow them if they insisted. The ruse succeeded splendidly. The inspectors agreed to allow him to occupy the flat on condition that he paid 6 months' rent in advance and that he came every 2 weeks to the police station to sign the alien's register. Every 2 weeks, Foote also went to Geneva, this time on the orders from Moscow, to meet Alexander Ratto in his offices at the Geo Press. The MGB had also fixed the times for his transmissions, twice a week on Wednesday and Saturday evenings. So in the first week of January 1941, Foote launched his appeals. NDA, comma, FRX, comma, NDA, FRX, NDA, FRX. Moscow did not reply. Foote did not even know if he was being heard, but he persevered, and suddenly on Wednesday, March the 12th, 1941, at 1:30 a.m., Foote received a very clear reply. NDA, OK, QSR 5. NDA, OK, QSR 5. Now, in any kind of a problem here in this country, as time goes on, that requires communications, you're going to have problems because the internet will probably be shut down or tightly controlled by the government, and the telephone service too. And so you'll probably need to rely at some point in the future on ham radio or marine radio, things like that, maybe even carrier pigeons. I'm telling you, low tech is going to be very important as time goes on. A volley of series of five letters and five figures concealed the agreed code. The dexterity of the Moscow operator was so great that Foote was unable to keep up and ask him to begin again. The message was an important one. Of course, you realize these were Morse code communications. And some people are very fast at reading code, some are not. At the peak of my expertise in Morse code, I guess I could read very well 20, 25 words a minute. In fact, many times I could translate it in my head without even writing it down. However, that's nothing. I was told that there have been Morse code operators who could operate at 60, 70 words a minute, sit back in a chair, relax, and catch up. That's amazing. The message was an important one. Following a series of reverses, most of the networks in Germany had been wiped out, and the MGB was suspicious of the little information that continued to arrive from the survivors. It was vital for the Soviet Union that the Radio League network should begin operations. On the night of March 15, 1941, Alexander Foote had hardly a moment's sleep. Rado had given him an enormous quantity of news for Moscow. There was information from Popko, Lily of the Vatican, and Isaac, but it was completely eclipsed by the extraordinary revelations of Lucy Rudolf Roessler. On February 20, 1941, said Lucy, the Germans had massed 650,000 men in Romania near the Ukraine border. On the night of February 28th, other German divisions crossed the Danube and took up positions in Bulgaria, following a secret agreement made 3 weeks before between Liszt, the special envoy of the OKW and the high command of Sofia. These troops were intended by Hitler to occupy Greece in the event the Allies decided to open a front above Salonika, as in 1914, in order to upset Operation Barbarossa. There followed a long report on Hitler's plans for the invasion of Russia. On March the 19th, the center's sharp reply came as a disappointment to Rado. How could this resident director imagine that Moscow would accept information from someone of whom they knew no more than a code name, and who, moreover, required as a condition of his cooperation complete secrecy concerning his sources? The dispatches communicated by this Lucy would be sensational if true. They were so detailed that they could almost have come from the OKW itself. Lucy should not be trusted. He was probably an agent provocateur. Now we go to Chapter 7. During the first few months of 1941, Roessler must have been sorely tempted to give up completely. It may well be his obstinacy and determination played a principal part in making this resistance story so remarkable. Through his 10 friends in the headquarters of the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht, Roessler was to know before the rest of the world the details of Hitler's every decision from 1939 up until the end of April 1945. Since the chiefs of staff to whom Hitler delivered his orders seldom remained in contact with the Führer for long, being replaced in their jobs after a matter of months, or sometimes even weeks, Roessler was in a unique position, for he had continuous knowledge of events that were to convulse the world, and was well aware of the importance of each piece of intelligence that passed through his hands. It was his knowledge, his sense of being at the center of world events, that must have sustained him in those early days of disillusionment and impotence, when first the Allies, then the Russians, refused him credence. Most men, as La Bruyere remarked, are more capable of a single great effort than a long perseverance in the pursuit of their aims. Boy, you find that out in this struggle. I mean, just see how few of the old timers are still around. And I'm not just talking about the ones that passed away. I'm talking about how many hundreds and hundreds of people I've known in this struggle that they come in, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. I used to call them skyrockets. They come in, they flame out, they put out a lot of brilliance in the sky, and then they're gone. And that's the way it's been in this struggle ever since I've been in it. I would say that less than 10% of the people who start in the struggle ever go the whole route, devote their whole life to it. But Roessler was different. He persevered, certain that in the end he would overcome the Russians' mistrust. So on March 27, 1941, despite the rebuff he had been given a week before, he contacted Christian Schneider. He had just received the news of the greatest importance. Hitler had decided to delay Operation Barbarossa for another 4 weeks. It had originally been set for May 15, 1941. If the Russians listened this time, they would have ample time to prepare themselves. Roessler then went to the Villa Stutz to inform the Swiss and to explain the reasons for the delay. 24 hours before, a popular uprising supported by a majority of the army had overthrown Prince Paul, the regent of Yugoslavia, and a Nazi sympathizer. The young heir to the throne, Peter II, had been declared king. General Dušan Simović immediately proposed a non-aggression pact with Germany, but the people had openly shown their hostility to the Führer by insulting his ambassador in Belgrade. Hitler was furious at being defied by a minor nation and decided to take wholesale reprisals. He immediately issued his directive number 25 addressed to the operational headquarters of the OKW. The military coup d'etat in Yugoslavia has altered the political situation in the Balkans. Despite her professions of loyalty, Yugoslavia must be regarded from now on as an enemy of Germany and be brought to heel as soon as possible. I therefore intend to invade her as well as Greece and wipe out their armies. Operations will begin at dawn on 6 April 1941. As a result, Operation Barbarossa will have to be delayed for 4 weeks. Roessler insisted that the Allies should be warned in time of the new upheaval in that part of Europe. He was a shrewd enough strategist to realize that the loss of these territories would constitute a serious blow to Britain. On the other hand, he was greatly relieved at the postponement of the invasion of Russia. This is a serious strategic error, he told Bureau HA in his analysis of the situation. A month's delay could ultimately prevent the Wehrmacht from achieving its objective, for it will be moving at the height of a terrible Russian winter. This error should favor the free world and all of this to satisfy Nazi pride. From that day, Thursday, March 27th onward, Roessler was in daily contact with his sources in Berlin. Each time, Roessler informed Christian Schneider that the Swiss at Kastanienbaum, the Swiss never seemed to mind this order of precedence. What mattered to them was that they were kept informed. In Radau's organization, on the other hand, there was increasing consternation over what they were to do with Lucy's information. On Saturday, March 29th, despite the orders of the center to ignore this dangerous source, Radau asked Foote to warn Moscow that evening that the mysterious Operation Barbarossa had postponed for 4 weeks. The MGB's answer on Wednesday, April 2nd, was short, sharp condemnation. Stop listening to this nonsense. Alexander Radau did not insist further. Each of the reports transmitted by Taylor got no further than his office. On April 25th, a violent argument erupted between the head of the network and his go-between, Schneider, having guessed that Radow's lack of interest, that Roessler's messages were no longer leaving Geneva. Quote, "We cannot go on dealing with our German friend so long as he persists in concealing the sources of his information. He will never reveal them. How do you know he isn't trying to use us?" "You're making a serious mistake, comrade. It's madness, treason. The Nazis are about to invade the Soviet Union, and if they win the war because Moscow didn't know all there was to know of their plans, then you will be partly responsible." "The center has given instructions that they wish to hear nothing more of your Lucy. Send them news anyway. It's your duty. I can't give you any convincing proof, but I can answer for him. He's as much an anti-Nazi as you or I. It's no use insisting. I'm not sending anything." In other words, the Russian government wouldn't accept any of this information. "Have you at least read the latest messages? The 17th German Armored Division, which was in central Poland, is now encamped in the Kelm Forest within gunshot of Russian territory. What's it doing there? General Heinrich von Stupnagel's 17th Army is advancing towards the Ukrainian border. What's it going to do there? Did you know that the Skoda Works in Czechoslovakia has been ordered by Berlin to stop taking orders for arms from the Soviet Union? Why? It's no use. I refuse to send all this." Schneider walked out, slamming the door of the GeoPress offices. The next day, he took the train for Lucerne to meet Roessler at the Vita Nova Verlag. He briefly explained Radow's attitude, trying rather clumsily to rationalize Moscow's decision. Roessler said that he understood. No one was willing to face up to the truth, but he would not give up. "Unfortunately, my dear Schneider, events will prove that we were right to persevere. Moscow will listen to us then." Throughout May 1941, the Russians heard no more from Lucy, but he was far from idle. Day after day, he had communicated to Christian Schneider, then to the Swiss, the movements of the Wehrmacht towards the Soviet frontiers. The group of armies under General Wilhelm von Lieb in the north, with 21 infantry divisions and 6 armored divisions. Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt's troops in the south, with 17 infantry divisions, 4 mountain divisions, 4 divisions of mobile infantry, and 5 armored divisions, and a formidable force under Field Marshal Fedor von Bock in the center, with 30 infantry and 15 armored divisions, over a front of almost 1,000 miles. 3 million men, 750,000 horses, 600,000 cars, 7,200 guns, 3,000 tanks, and 1,800 planes were awaiting D-Day at H hour. Roessler had enumerated everything in detail. It was an extraordinary piece of work. He had also described the state of mind of the troops concentrated at Tilsit, Insterberg, Zakenau, Chelm, Balowski, Peremsel, and Jassy. Above all, he had particularly emphasized the invasion plans assigned to this enormous war machine. Von Lieb's mission was to cross the Memel, wipe out the Russian troops throughout the Baltic states, and move on to Leningrad. His spearhead would be General Hoepner's armored divisions. Von Bock's objectives were first Smolensk and then Moscow, with 2 groups of armored troops commanded by the best generals of the Wehrmacht, Guderian and Hoth. Von Rundstedt would make a breakthrough between the Prepet Marshes and the Carpathians, invade Ukraine, and if possible reach Kiev. Boy, it's just like in the news today. The strategy devised by the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht seemed perfectly clear. A great effort would be made in the center, across a marshy region crossed by a great many rivers, which it would at least they would be least expected. The Russian front would be broken, and the Russian armies encircled in a number of pockets. In the same movement, all the great vital centers would be occupied. Throughout that May and the first week of June 41, Alexander Rado had trouble sleeping. He read and reread the intelligence from Lucy. Perhaps the center was wrong after all. Why not trust Lucy? He couldn't get Christian Snyder's words out of his mind. You will be partly responsible. The Kremlin had never had any difficulty in finding a scapegoat when things went wrong. Curiously enough, Alexander Foote offered the same reasoning when the two men met some days later, on Thursday, June 12, 1941, the night before Schneider had come to see Radow. They had scarcely been on speaking terms since the night of their argument. He had simply placed a piece of paper on Radow's desk. Radow could hardly believe his eyes when he read the message written on it. Quote, "General attack on territories occupied by Russians, dawn, Sunday, 22nd of June, 3:15 a.m. When Schneider had satisfied himself that Rado had taken in the message, he turned on his heels and went out without a word. All night, Rado suffered the agony of indecision. On the morning of Thursday, June 12, unable to bear it any longer, he telephoned Foote, something he had never done before. Sounding deeply upset, he asked the Englishman to come at once to Geneva, having insisted that Radow should meet him at the Gare de Cornavin at noon. Foote cursed and hung up. The two spies walked silently down the Rue du Mont Blanc to the bridge that closes Lake Lemin at the point where the Rhone continues on its way into France. They then turned left, stopping at a distance from the casino in front of the landing stages, which in peacetime were used by pleasure boats. There on a bench overlooking the lake, Radow found Foote's message. What are you going to do? Foote asked. After a long silence, Radow murmured, "What can I do? You know how skeptical the center in Moscow was about Lucy's information. Perhaps the information isn't true." Foote made no secret of his annoyance. "So you brought me all this way here just to tell me that you haven't made up your mind yet? If I were you, I'd send the information all the same. It would then be up to the center to accept responsibility. Who knows, you might later be accused of criminal negligence. I wouldn't like to be in your shoes then." The prospect of what lay ahead, if this were the case, suddenly forced Radow's hand. He gave Foote the message. "Send it at the next normal transmitting time, the day after tomorrow. Come back to my office with me and I'll give you a dossier I've got in my safe. All the information sent in by Lucy for the past month. Ask the sender to give you 3 or 4 extra transmitting times. You'll need them to send that lot out. Never mind if they don't like it, at least we will have done our duty." So on June 14th, then on 16th, 17th, and 18th, 1941, Alexander Foote kept at his transmitter. The only answer he got was, "Understood, over." When he had finished burning all the papers and all the code jottings, Foote collapsed into his bed exhausted. He slept the next 24 hours. He would have liked to have kept a copy of all this exceptional intelligence for his later use, but the orders of the MGB were that everything must be destroyed. This time, the Russians showed no suspicion of Lucy's information. So many other sources confirmed the date of the invasion that they would have been mad not to believe the rest, which was infinitely more important. In fact, the date June 22nd had been confirmed by Richard Sorge, the best Soviet agent in the Far East. Moreover, Cordell Hull and Sumner Wells, the American Secretary and Under Secretary of State, had just warned Konstantin Yumansky, the Soviet ambassador to Washington, that they had received word from their legations in Europe of a planned invasion of Russia by the Germans. Finally, the date had also been confirmed by Churchill, who had got wind of it through his espionage network in Germany. See, Russia was not prepared at all. The right wing and the Cardo bunch in this country, they'll feed you the crap that they broke open a safe over there in Eastern Europe and found the invasion plans, and Stalin was ready to invade Western Europe, invade Germany. That's all bullshit. But it's peddled by the right wing, and they keep peddling it, and they've peddled it for 40 years that I've known of. The MGB was in a turmoil of doubt. The arguments were reviewed time and time again. See, not only wasn't Russia mobilizing, they didn't believe the stuff until too late. The arguments were reviewed time and time again. Had Stalin perhaps been wrong to base everything on the non-aggression pact signed with Hitler? Yes. Stalin trusted Hitler. Stalin liked Hitler. And when the invasion happened, Stalin is said to have gone into seclusion for 10 days. They couldn't even get him out of his inner office. He was totally crushed that Hitler would have attacked him. If so, he was making a terrible mistake in not alerting the 4.5 million soldiers of the Red Army at the frontier. The Army High Command had long been recommending this. Moreover, there were other facts, apart from the intelligence that had come from the espionage sources, that indicated that something was wrong on beyond, something was going on beyond the Western frontier. Why didn't the Soviets have spies over there watching these giant movements of tanks and horses and planes and everything? I mean, you know, it'd be like us not keeping an eye on Mexico. Well, wait a minute. We don't keep an eye on In the past 2 months, 24 German reconnaissance planes had flown well into Soviet territory, and one of them had crashed. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. It's almost as amazing as them not accepting Rossler's intelligence information on the invasion of the Low Countries in the West that had happened previously. It seems to me, after studying a lot of this stuff over the years, that there's a lot of stupidity in the higher commands of all these outfits. I guess the only reason one side wins is because they made less mistakes, I guess. In the past 2 months, 24 German reconnaissance planes had flown well into Soviet territory, and one of them had crashed. Top quality cameras had been found in the wreckage, with film that left no doubt that their sole mission had been to photograph Soviet military installations. Moreover, for the past 3 months, German firms that should have fulfilled the terms of economic contracts signed on January 10th had stopped sending their goods to Russia. You know, it's strange, but at the same time Hitler's planning all this, thousands of German engineers had been going into Russia each year, rebuilding the infrastructure of Russia. I mean, it's amazing that the general population of Germany did not feel that they wanted to wipe out Russia. In fact, and of course, so much of the military is very pro-Russian. And then Hitler, on the other side, is turning things upside down and going to have this invasion. Yet the Russians continued to prove their good faith by increasing their supplies of cereals, gasoline, ferrous and non-ferrous metals, and rubber. In other words, even though they had the plans that Hitler was going to attack, the Russians were still shipping massive amounts of stuff to Germany. Ah, it drives you crazy. Finally, well-informed newspapers throughout the world studied attentively every day in the Ministry of Security made continual references to the German troop concentrations on the Russian border frontiers. Yes, Stalin might well have been wrong. Although Stalin had forbidden that any defensive moves be made along the frontiers, fearing that they might be interpreted by Hitler as acts of defiance. You know, everybody says how hard and tough Stalin was. Well, he sure had some weak points, that's for sure. The MGB sent a discreet warning to the Red Army High Command, but the results of the center's second thoughts could no longer spare the Soviet Union, hidden in the dense Polish fir forest, under the oaks, beeches, and ashes of the Carpathians, and amid the cane apples and laurels of Bessarabia. 146 divisions lay ready to attack. And Stalin didn't want to offend the Germans. The men were in a peak condition and in high morale and dreamed of succeeding where Napoleon had failed. Ugh. In Berlin, Joachim von Ribbentrop, a German foreign minister, was already composing the coded message to send to his ambassador in Moscow, Count Friedrich von der Schulenburg. It was one of the Führer's most cynical declarations of war. Quote, information received in the past few days by the government of the Reich leaves no doubt as to aggressive nature of the Soviet troop movements. Now, this is what the right wing has bought this bullshit. And you ask them, they'll say, oh, Metzger's crazy. Moreover, intelligence from a British source had confirmed the existence of the negotiations conducted by the British ambassador, Sir Stafford Cripps, to establish close military cooperation between Great Britain and the Soviet Union. The government of the Reich declares that in violation of its solemn engagements of the Soviet government has been guilty, A, of having continued and intensified its maneuvers with a view of undermining Germany and the rest of Europe. Well, militarily, that certainly wasn't true. B, of having assembled on the German frontier all of its armed forces on a war footing. That was a lie. C, of making preparations of an obvious kind and in violation of the German-Russian non-aggression pact to attack Germany. And that was a lie. As a result, the Führer has ordered the armed forces of the Reich to meet such a threat with every means at their disposal. At twilight of the afternoon of June 21, 1941, an embarrassed von der Schulenburg arrived at the Kremlin to present Molotov with Hitler's message. 9 hours later, on a front of more than 600 miles, a wave of fire swept across the Russian territory. The war in the East had begun. So if Stalin had listened to the warnings and prepared on a full war footing and moved tremendous numbers of his troops to the west, and Hitler had attacked, it would have gotten bogged down, probably. At least the Soviet armies might have had to retreat slowly, but Hitler could have never made the inroads in Russia he did. And so it would have probably boiled down to some kind of a negotiated peace with neither side being able to win, really. Of course, this was all total insanity because of the non-aggression pact, and Russia was observing that non-aggression pact, and Hitler was making excuses to get around it. Yep. Sorry, right wing. I got to tell you the truth. On June 23, 1941, Rudolf Rösler was to discover two of the center's best qualities, a profound contempt for wounds inflicted on its armor proprie and a remarkable capacity to adapt itself to changing circumstances. For 2.5 months, the Russians had stubbornly refused to listen to Lucy's shouts of alarm. Now overnight their attitude was transformed. They offered the despised Lucy more money than had ever been paid a secret agent and begged him to go on with his vital work. Yeah, they all love you when you turn out to be right. In fact, the very night before, Alexander Foote had turned his transmitter receiver to the wavelength usually used by the MGB. It was not his customary day for transmitting, and he was afraid that he would get no reply. But disturbed by the new turn taken by the war, he felt a deep need to be in touch with Moscow. Suddenly, Foote was startled by the increasingly sharp whistle in his headphones. Someone was on the wavelength. The whistle stopped, and it was followed by a series of two dashes and two dots. Z, 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 Z. It was the center. Foote recognized its signature at once. A flood of letters and figures arrived. Then silence. Foote made use of the break to translate the dispatch. Calling all networks, calling all networks. The fascist beasts have invaded the workers' fatherland. The moment has come to do all in our power to help the USSR in its struggle against Germany, signed the director. After a short interval, the center continued its transmission. NDA, 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 special message. NDA was Foote. NDA, the center, had decided that from now on, the dispatches will be divided into three categories. The MSG will designate routine communications, the RDO, urgent messages, and the VYRDO will preface messages of the greatest importance. From today, all intelligence communications by Lucy will be classified as VYRDO and be relayed immediately. The center will be on alert for communications 24 hours a day. NDA alone will transmit Lucy's communications. Edwards and Rossi will be duly informed. It's always closing the door after the horse is gone, man. The horse done gone. Those Deutschers are coming. Run for your lives. Edwards and Rosie, were, of course, Hamill and Margaret Booley, Radow's personal wireless operators. Things must be getting very serious, Foote thought. Within a few seconds, he was certain of it. He was ordered by the MGB in Moscow to contact Lucy at once. Moscow anxiously awaited all his intelligence. He was to be paid a regular salary of 7,000 Swiss francs a month, about $1,600, not including additional payments for exceptional intelligence. In 1941, a monthly salary of 7,000 Swiss francs was something of a fortune. In fact, for a while, he used nearly all of it to keep the network going. Sometimes it was not even enough. The regular messages between Lucerne and Geneva, code experts, and the wireless operators of Radow's network all made personal contributions to the funds of the organization in order that the struggle might continue. Up until June 1941, things had been relatively easy. The economic service of Vladimir Dekhanozov, the Soviet ambassador in Berlin, had been instructed to provide a plentiful flow of money for the network. The only difficulty was in getting the money to Switzerland. Radow solved this problem simply by getting one of his agents to bring the money in secretly. When the Berlin embassy was closed, Moscow ordered the resident director of its last espionage network in Europe to get its supply of funds from the Swiss Communist Party, and these advances would be repaid later. Unfortunately, Leon Nicole's party was itself short of money and said that it would be unable to comply. Radow lost his temper, and the center became increasingly angry. At this point, Foote conceived a simple scheme based entirely on trust. some of his English acquaintances in Lausanne had introduced him to one of the directors of the Lausanne branch of an important American company. For the benefit of this American, he would play up his role of eccentric and extravagant millionaire and ask help in getting money into Switzerland. He would say that he'd be willing to pay the black market rate of interest. All that was needed was for the MGB, through someone who could not be suspected of working for the Russians, to credit the bank account of the company in New York with the necessary funds. The company would then credit its Lausanne branch with an equivalent sum in Swiss francs, and it would deliver the money to Foote after subtracting the agreed commission. The center agreed to the idea at once. Nothing could be easier than sending money to the United States. The director of the Lausanne branch also complied, believing he was doing a good turn to a rich English gentleman. The company in New York did not object either, being quite unaware that it was involuntarily helping to finance Soviet espionage network. Laundering money, man, goes back a long way. Okay, the directors of the company in New York nor the American in Lausanne expressed the slightest surprise at the size of the sums of transfer. None of these transactions took more than 10 days to complete, which must have been a record for those troubled times. Money did nothing to change Roessler's habits. He continued to rise at 6:30 every morning, eat his frugal breakfast of coffee and toast, and 7:30 leave home to catch the trolley, which took him to the center of Lucerne. At 8, he opened the Vita Nova bookshop in the Futtmaster. His mornings were devoted to correspondence and to the day-to-day affairs of his publishing business. At noon, he went home to lunch. His tastes in food were extremely simple, not to say his wardrobe was limited, and he wore his clothes until they were threadbare. A dark, ready-made suit, a long black overcoat for winter, an outsized trench coat for other seasons, and a soft felt hat that he wore pulled down over his ears. Roessler did not smoke, as he suffered from frequent exhausting asthma attacks. He appeared to have only one weakness, coffee. He drank coffee incessantly, at home, at the office, at the Villa Stutz in Kastenbaum, and well into the night. Roessler devoted his afternoons to his work for the Swiss Secret Service, correlating and evaluating all the intelligence they had supplied him with for the use of Brigadier Masson. The Brigadier always took Roessler's reports with him when he attended the meetings of the Swiss High Command. After dinner, the German emigre again became an active agent, engaged in the radio telegraphy that linked him to his friends in the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht. He often worked until 3 o'clock in the morning, decoding and writing up the dispatches from Weather and Olga. It wouldn't have been that hard to detect the spy ring in the German high command. It's amazing that they got away with that. He often worked until 3 o'clock in the morning, decoding, writing up dispatches for Weather and Olga. In addition, Roessler never ceased to perform his role as Lucy, forever at the disposition of Christian Schneider, his go-between, finding time to transmit news concerning the Soviet Union to the Russians and to carry out the instructions he received from them. He gave up going to the theater and the movies, fearing that he might miss a transmission. He took no time off, no holidays, not even a weekend. The Russians paid him well, and he accepted their money. Christian Schneider had insisted that it did not, Moscow might again grow suspicious. But even if he had not been paid by the center, he would have worked just as diligently for them. Roessler cared for nothing but the defeat of the Nazis. Above all, tell Lucy that he must not worry about the payments in the events of delays. The director of the center declared on June 25, 1941, then again on June 30th of that year. Make it perfectly clear to Lucy that in the event of irregularities in the payment of his salary, he must be patient and in no way slacken his efforts at this crucial time in our struggle against Hitler. We will never fail to meet our obligations. Lucy could not have cared less, for contrary to the image the MGB had created of him, he was not in the least a mercenary. It might be said that the MGB was the only part of the Soviet war machine to work effectively against Nazi Germany. During the first months of the war, elsewhere on the fronts, the Russian soldiers whose job the MGB should normally have made easier collapsed under the German attack, and the enormous advantages which the Russians possessed of knowing the enemy's plans in advance was at first little use. The intelligence had come too late. The Russians needed time to recover from the first unexpected blows before they could benefit fully from their good fortune. This took 3 months, during which the Germans began to suspect that some deadly parasite had invaded their system and was sapping its strength. In fact, on July 2nd, 10 days after the beginning of the war in the East, Lucy confirmed to the MGB in Moscow that the German plan of attack had Moscow as its immediate objective. Most of the German effort would be concentrated on the central front by the tanks of Guderian and Hoth. The troop movements in the north and south would be little more than diversions. This was what the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht had called Plan I. On July 27, 1941, Lucy asked Radow to warn the center in Moscow at once that the OKW, sensing that the Russians were building up the resistance on the central front, had suddenly switched to Plan II. This involved two main thrusts from the south and north and the south in a pincer movement in order to give some respite to the troops of Field Marshal von Bock. These were obviously two vital pieces of intelligence. If the Red Army was capable of containing the German advance on all fronts, at least its commander-in-chief, Marshal Boris Mikhailovich Shapovnikov, was able to communicate at once to the corps commanders at the front those items of Lucy's intelligence that were relevant to them. As a result, there was an important change of tactics, accompanied by an avalanche of details concerning the units that the Soviet troops would find in front of them. Nevertheless, on August 10, 1941, the fighting post headquarters in the 16th Russian Army fell intact into the hands of General Haas Panzer Grenadiers east of Smolensk. The military security officers blew open the door of a rusty safe and were stunned to discover among a mass of paperwork exact copies of Russians' OKW 2 plans of the campaign, as well as a copy of the sudden decision to adopt the second of two. A few days before this discovery, the German military security officers had found another packet of confidential papers in an office abandoned by the general commanding the 1st Cossack Army of Lomza. To their amazement, they realized that the Red Army knew of the weak spot in the organization of the German army, the Wehrmacht's Achilles heel in 1941, which was to remain a vulnerable point despite successive improvements, was supplies. Roessler never ceased to concern himself with this problem throughout the war. The first information on the subject, which he gave to Christian Schneider for the transmission to Moscow, was early on June 27, 1941. It consisted of a complete operations chart and had taken Alexander Foote 4 hours to transmit. That's a lot of pounding the brass, as we used to call it when you work Morse code. You used to call it pounding the brass. Throw everything into the attack was invariably Hitler's order when drawing up his campaign plans, and the OKW complied. As a result, the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht was no longer capable of making large-scale plans for retreat when things ceased to go in their favor. The Wehrmacht appeared to have one universal tactic: concentrate all available troops in a single overwhelming breakthrough and annihilate the enemy in one blow. The assault plans of the OKW were remarkable and could be studied with profit by military schools even today. The same cannot be said of their support organizations, which was far too unwieldy ever to be adapted to shock tactics. Hitler decreed that the German soldier was not to feel weighed down in his lightning attacks. No special supply service would be attached to the fighting units. Food, ammunition, fuel, spare parts, or even medical supplies would be brought up as close as possible to the fighting line and placed in clearings where the combatants would come to supply their needs. These depots were enormous. For an infantry division of the Wehrmacht consumed 130 tons of general supplies in a day. A panzer division 300 tons, an army 5,000 tons, and a group of armies such as those under von Bloch, von Loeb, and von Rundstedt 18,000 tons. 18,000 tons a day, the equivalent of 36 train loads of supplies. It was a supply problem that was inevitably to confound the Wehrmacht. Just think of the supply lines between Germany and the front. Every day, 18,000 tons a day. No way it could go on for very long. One has only to imagine the long cohorts of vehicles from the fighting units returning to the rear lines to get their food and supplies, and the inextricable traffic jams around these monstrous compounds. This is exactly what it was like on the Eastern Front. Against a background of dust, mud, or snow, according to the season. Moreover, these vast depots provided magnificent objectives for the enemy air force. When the OKW strategists were preparing Operation Barbarossa, first on a 1/1,000th map of Russia, published in 1896, then later on more modern maps of a 1/500,000 scale, they carefully selected the sites for these huge mobile depots in relation to the advance into Russia, as well as the routes to be followed by the troops to reach them. These were the weak spots that Roessler revealed to Radow, which the Russians carefully transferred to their own maps. For the Germans, the dramatic discovery of Lomza meant only one thing: the enemy seemed to be remarkably well informed. Yeah, perhaps they even had spies within the Wehrmacht itself. Yeah, you catch on fast, or you catch on slow. This impression soon became a certainty, and on August 10, 1941, Roessler informed Radow, as well as the Bureau HA at Kostenbaum, that the Wehrmacht High Command had decided to adopt a modified version of Plan 1. The group of armies at the center, commanded by Marshal von Bock, would attack again through the Brinsk in the direction of Moscow. General Halder, the Chief of Staff, proposed this modified plan to the Führer only on August 18th. The OKW services in the Camp Zosen, near Berlin, worked at top speed on its practical details. Among the technicians involved in the work were Roessler's 10 accomplices. Thus, Roessler got full details of the plan 8 days before its submission to the Führer. Stalin was immediately informed, and he and Marshal Shaposhnikov resolved to make a lightning attack on the Wehrmacht, the first Russian attack since the beginning of the conflict. On August 12th, they called in their best tank technician, Aramenko. Guderian will attack Moscow in a week's time, Stalin told him. He will go through Bryansk. I want you to assume command of the defense of this front. I shall even send you as reinforcements the 3rd and 21st Armies, which are to be present in the Ukraine. We're safe there for the moment. You have a difficult task to accomplish. It was then that the history and the Führer, whose sudden decisions were always unpredictable and enigmatic, played a dramatic trick on the Russians. On August 18th, as Lucy had said, Halder took his plan to Hitler, who was then in his wartime headquarters, Wilhelmshöhe, in Rastenburg in East Prussia, a damp, densely wooded area. The conference lasted 5 days. Hitler seemed to in a particularly gloomy mood as the generals whom he terrorized and even insulted waited submissively for a decision. The war was dragging too much for his taste. Moscow could wait. He wanted the Ukraine and its rich grain fields. Guderian, who wanted to take the Soviet capital, which he felt was within the grasp of his tanks, could not change Hitler's mind. Another fatal flaw of Hitler: not going for Moscow, going for the so-called grain fields. That's a mop-up operation. You do that after you've got the capital and the government. Attack at once in the south, Hitler ordered. Link up with von Rundstedt's armies and attack and get me Kiev. That was the crucial moment that upset Lucy's predictions and confounded Stalin, who continued to prepare for the Bronsk-Moscow operation and had transferred his defenses from the Ukraine for that purpose. Rosler's friends knew nothing of the Führer's latest turnabout, and they were to learn nothing more for the next few days. This was because the OKW had had no hand in drawing up the new plans for Guderian's breakthrough. Guderian had left to exercise his own initiative as the occasion arose, and increasingly they found this out. Plans that were made this way, the Germans were still winning, but the plans through the OKW that the spies were getting a hold of, they began to lose. Well, that's it for today. I hope I haven't bored you to death, but I think it's information that needs to get out there, just for, if not the history of the situation, but the, you know, its impact on future problems, maybe not on that larger scale, but on smaller scale for unconventional warfare that may come to us in this country. 14.5, I'll be back with you tomorrow on Thursday.